for higher risk for ATEs, we do know. We do know that people, ironically, the group who are aspirin takers, who probably are at higher risk, have a lower risk of ATEs, maybe because they're taking aspirin. That's a pretty big stretch, but it's theoretically quite reasonable.
ATEs on Bev?
On Bev. If you look at the post-hoc analysis of patients who are aspirin takers, and if they're aspirin takers, it's probably because there's a pretest probability that they have vascular disease or worry about it, they actually have a lower rate of an ATE, an arteriothrombotic event. So a practical answer is, what do I do? Control hypertension very carefully. If there are no contraindications, a baby aspirin. That's not bad for most of us. It's probably good for preventing colon cancer, but it's also good for vascular disease. And as my mother would say, it can't hurt.
And in the metastatic setting, of course, you have to balance the threat of the tumor. You know, how do you sort of kind of come up with an estimate based on prior events, how long the events were, what type of events, and sort of putting together a decision?
In terms of the predisposition to ATEs?
Right.
You're right. You have to have that long-term discussion about the problems related to the tumor versus the potential problems related to the drug. So that if I have a patient, and I think we do tend to fall into the theory that all patients are created equal, and they're not. So take two patients. One is a 78-year-old person with three pulmonary nodules not considered curable by surgical resection with a prior history of an MI 5 years ago. The other is a 40-year-old patient with bulky disease causing pain and leading to a decreased performance status, yet with serosal implants. Well, in one, I'd be comfortable in saying, I'm not even sure, first, that I even need to treat this patient right now. We just happen to have found, by lead time bias, three pulmonary nodules that are asymptomatic. Do I really need to throw everything at that patient? Or, as in breast cancer, is it true, perhaps, that sequential single-agent therapies might be just as good as everything up front? Conversely, in the patient who is sick from their tumor, doing sequential therapies may not be a real smart thing to do. If you wait until they become ecteric because their liver is too big, you might lose the opportunity to use one of the three chemotherapeutic drugs, irinotecan. As you know, two of the ASCO abstracts this year, I think, were on a regimen sometimes called FOLFIRINOX, which is all three drugs. And unsurprisingly, the response rate was quite high with that. So was toxicity. But if you had a patient with bulky disease and impending obstruction of an organ, it might be reasonable to consider that FOLFIRINOX plus both biologics, which could be the endpoint of one of the arms of the current intergroup trial to some degree, of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus either cetuximab or bevacizumab or both, based on the toxicity and efficacy data from the BOND-2 trial for both cetuximab and bevacizumab, you might consider all of those. I gave one patient FOLFOX, as it turned out, plus bevacizumab plus cetuximab recently because they presented in a young individual with both a intact primary, big-time omental and intraperitoneal disease and ascites, and was in pain, requiring fentanyl. And I treated the patient, and 2 weeks later, with FOLFOX plus bevacizumab plus cetuximab, because they weren't eligible for the trial, it wasn't active yet in our institution indeed, but based on data and based on intuition, because I thought response was important, that median survivorship was not an issue for this patient, it was response. And about a week into the treatment, the patient's mother called me and said, you know, I don't know what you're doing to my son, but he's lost 12 pounds this week. And I said, well, can I talk to him? She said, no, he's out on his motorcycle. And the actuality was he lost 12 pounds because he diureased all his ascites. And he had an unbelievable response. And frankly, it was the first time, Neil, that I was worried that I might have caused tumor lysis in a colon cancer patient because he had such a rapid response. And sometimes this even leads to misleading sorts of pieces of information like rising CEAs, rising LDHs a week or two into biochemotherapy because the tumor is so responsive as opposed to unresponsive that those levels actually go up before they go down again.
I'm trying to think whether I should do some type of warning like they do when they, you know, the test drivers. This is an experienced test driver. Do not try this
at home.
Or not FDA approved or whatever.
Well, I think it speaks to the heterogeneity of our patient population that saying that FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab is the first-line therapy for every patient. It can't be true. It must be true that there are some patients in whom sequential therapies are going to be just as good as multiple combinations up front. And if one only uses medians, you're going to dummy down the data and go counterintuitive to what the average clinician and patient understands about their disease.
Getting back to the issue of the ATEs and, you know, when you pull the trigger with metastatic disease, you're a 78-year-old man. with a prior MI, assuming he were sicker or you needed a response more quickly, would you consider adding bevacizumab in a patient like that?
I absolutely would. I think that every therapy we give has a certain inherent toxicity. And just because this is a unique toxicity we've not dealt with before, older people are more likely to have febrile neutropenia. They have less good bone marrows. So I think, again, I'm a believer in aspirin for a lot of different reasons. So I do think, yes, I would control hypertension. I would have the patient followed by their cardiologist with me if they had a cardiac disease. I'd think about aspirin as something one could administer. One is never going to do a trial of aspirin, yes or no, in a prospective sense. So you have to do the best with the data you have. And then you have to explain to the patient that you might have a slightly increased risk of this event, and we can't predict it, but these are the things we're going to do to try to reduce your risk. But the end point is better control of your tumor, and it's important because. And if you can't explain why, that is, we're going to reduce your pain, increase your personal survival by X or Y. The other is that, for example, with hypertension, at least that one sort of creeps up on you. It's not an acute event. I think perforation and a TIA are unpredictable events. But again, these are patients with cancer. They have those events as a baseline.
Is there a formula that you can look at to try to predict the chance of AT? I mean, for example, let's say this man had his MI 6 months ago. Is there an age? Is there a way to come up with a more tangible number?
There really is not. I mean, there are the data, and I think the data from the, it's called the BEAT trial by Roche, B-E-A-T, in Europe, which is really a registry trial, and the BRIGHT registry trial in the U.S. will at least give us numbers and proportionality. But I don't think that it's going to happen that one is going to be able to plug in those data into a Gale model, for example, or a predictive model as for adjuvant therapy of colon cancer and say your baseline risk of a pulmonary embolism or a clot in your left median carotid artery is blank and with bevacizumab it's 1.8 blank. I just think one needs to know it's not 10 times or, you know, a hazard ratio of 0.89 or 0.92. I think one just needs to be a clinician.